This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Writing pregens.
Another labyrinth candidate.
Melodrama.
And the Pentagon UFO files.
Big news from Mission Control. If you missed out the first time, don't panic. The wait is over. The Catstronauts board game is finally back in stock at Atlas Games.
That's right. Catstronauts sold out almost immediately on release, but the reprint has officially landed. Now you can finally bring the kitty crew home to your tabletop.
And just in time, too, because things are getting interesting on the International Space Station.
Giant laser pointers in space and a live stream of nose boops? What's not to like? Let's check out how the Catstronauts are doing up there.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Careful, Waffles. If the other Catstronauts catch you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, it's back to litter box duty for you.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady. Pom Pom is swatting at fasteners like feather toys. And Major Meowser is... napping on the instructions.
Teamwork at its finest. You can lead this kitty crew yourself in the official Catstronauts board game.
It's a cooperative challenge featuring pawsome art by the comics creator Drew Brockington, and it's perfect for gamers of all ages.
But remember, the first printing disappeared at light speed. Don't let this reprint of Catstronauts slip through your claws.
Secure your copy today at atlas-games.com/catstronauts. That's atlas-games.com/catstronauts. The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the gaming hut. And sitting around the table at the gaming hut, we notice that there are fun hats and a little wig and some sort of a bow tie, it looks like. Well, this isn't a LARPing hut. These must be symbols of a character's interesting story that they have. What's the story behind that fun hat? Why is your hair green? Why are you in a bow tie in a dungeon? So many questions. The questions about your pre-generated characters, because obviously if it was your character, you'd know why you're wearing a bow tie in a dungeon. But these are pregens that have been supplied to us by the GM. And the question is, when you are given a pregen, this is the question that Robin is posing, when you're given a pregen, do you want to be the guy who wears the bow tie in the dungeon, or do you want to be gnome illusionist thief, let's get to killing?
Right. Or I guess more to the point I had in mind, how long a description do you want of your guy with the bow tie in the dungeon or your history as a gnome illusionist? Whether you are writing for publication or you're a GM writing up pregens for a demo, we often think of that as, hey, we're writers. Here's our opportunity to write, to give the players something that we've written to read. And consequently, you can sometimes wind up with, including in published products, some 300 to 500 word descriptions of those characters. And perhaps you're hearing me begin to unfurl my thesis because I would argue that the point of a pregen is to get you started quickly, and that what players need in order to have fun playing a character in a game is probably less than 500 words of writing. Because if you have a relatively long, therefore complicated bio to read, it's a similar situation, I guess, to if you as a player love to write a detailed backstory for your character, that's all well and good, as long as that somehow informs your play. You obviously enjoy doing that, and maybe the other players will get to enjoy it if you bring those things out in play, or even if you have interesting behavior that's driven by your biography without ever mentioning it to anybody. But for a player starting at the table, how much do you really want? So I'm arguing it's not a lengthy session of everybody sitting and reading their character biographies at the very moment at the beginning of the game when you most want everybody locking in and paying attention to each other rather than having a little homework read. But Ken, how much do you think players actually want? Am I wrong? Are there people who want to sit down and get a detailed biography of a character before they play them?
I think it hugely depends on, at first order, the sort of the genre of play that you're going to be having. In my experience, in a LARP, people want big, meaty biographies. They want character backgrounds. I think LARPs maybe attract the player who wants the blue book full of character background. And so those players expect it. And also, in a LARP, the action is going to be interpersonal action by and large, driven by character motive. And so the question of what is my character is much more salient to play than a straight up F20 dungeon. You have all gathered in a tavern. There is a treasure. It is guarded by monsters. Let's get to it. And for that sort of play, maybe you don't need anything except, you know, your character's name, rank, you know, level, class, you know, a special item that they have with them, their cool hammer or their neat scroll or whatever it is. And they're ready to jump in and play because that is very tactical thinking and very little of it is informed by player history. And then in the middle, I would argue, is your sort of investigatory horror or other sorts of genres where player motive is important. I'm in this haunted house because my uncle left it to me. I'm in this haunted house because I suspect another one of the player characters of being a jewel thief, and I don't want her to be left alone to secrete the jewels in this haunted house. Whatever it is, those sorts of motives, which might or might not just be the drive in a gumshoe game, are still, I think, relevant to play and relevant to sort of locking into your character and saying, why am I up this late at night being hassled by ghouls when I could just as easily be in my bed in 1934 thinking about beans, you know, whatever it is. And so I think that the type of action that you're expecting, which is usually informed by the genre of the game, is going to determine how much character you want and need in order to begin taking bites out of the scenario in the way that the GM or the designer intended.
And so as the person writing the pre-gens, the question is, how much of what you're presenting to people is playable? As you say, in a LARP, a big chunk of biography is desired, and it's desired because it is playable. Each of those paragraphs is going to say something probably about your relationship to another person in the LARP, and that will be a cue to go, oh, you should go and talk to this person about your long-lost cousin. And in a LARP, those instructions, which come in the form, in many cases, of biography, are the very grist of play. In order for anything to happen, you have to start looking at your biography or your goals or whatever it is in your description and go and act on that. And it's usually a relatively long, you know, 3 to 4 hour slot. And so you need another thing to do when your first thing plays out. And half the time, perhaps other people will be coming to you to pitch you on different things, but that's because they have found those in the character descriptions. So the answer, I guess, really isn't about how long a description or biography should be, but on how playable its different units are. So that if you're writing, just sort of getting carried away and writing the biography of the guy with the bow tie who goes down into the dungeon and his fascination with bow ties, that will be very confusing for the player if they then go, wow, this is very important. Obviously, this is the Dungeon of Bow Ties. When I go down, there'll be some neckwear related revelation that I'm going to be expected to take part in. And if you have just sort of randomly come up with a bunch of quirks, they're going to be frustrated no matter how long or short your description is. If you just say, you are fascinated by bow ties and always wear one, and that's all I get in my pre-gen, I'm going to really expect some sort of bow tie related thing to happen. So make sure that you are setting up things in your pre-gen description that are cues for things to actually do in play, whether those things are just riffing with another character. You know, you can just say, you know, your friend the dwarf always makes fun of your bow ties and it makes you mad. Maybe that's the only thing, is it say that you're being supplied with some banter to do in between fighting skeletons. But the question is this pertinent? And also, I guess the next one is this easy to get at? If there's a really long, involved backstory involving your relationships to all of the other characters, are you going to be able to remember it based on a chunk of text, or does the GM or designer need to break things out more, to bullet point things more, to move it more clearly from a piece of microfiction into a set of instructions of stuff to do?
Yeah, you can break a lot of those things out mechanically, like with drives in Gumshoe or like bonds in Dungeon World. You know, which of these characters do you trust? Which of these characters do you need to protect? Those sorts of questions can be done as bullet points as opposed to as lengthy backstories. And even if they're bullet points, the answer can be more than just, I trust Kragar. You can say, I trust Kragar because he saved my life in the chasm of pain. And then it's like, now we have a thing that we can mention, and it sort of builds on why we trust Kragar, not just because he has an honest face, but because he actually did something really cool. And, you know, who do you need to protect? Well, that nebbish in the bow tie, obviously, he wouldn't last a minute in the chasm of pain. We need to look out for him. Me and Kragar do. And that then can inform by play, as you say, in a F20 dungeon, or it can even maybe be the goal of the dungeon. An F20 dungeon doesn't have to be a straight kill and take. There can be story dimension, and often is. And especially in like a one shot, it's like, oh, this dungeon has an opening that leads into the chasm of pain, and we have to get through it to get to the giant ruby or whatever. And this is, you know, why all this backstory is suddenly relevant is now we're making a decision. Do we go through the chasm of pain knowing what a bad scene it is? Or do we say, you know what? We've got plenty of treasure. We're, you know, 45 minutes from the end of the session. Maybe we just go back to that one room and wail on those skeletons a little more, and that'll be fine. And so it can still inform you. And especially in a one shot, or as you say, a pre-published scenario, that character drama moment can be assumed to be part of play, or desired to be part of play on the part of designer.
Another question you can ask yourself when you're writing a more detailed set of instructions, i.e. a biography, is how much of this can I move out of the siloed experience of everybody sits there reading their character sheet, and how much can I move into an interactive moment where everybody at the table, if it's pre-gens, maybe you're running for the same group of people all the time and you switch games all the time, in which case this is less of an issue. But a lot of times pre-gens are for a convention environment or a pickup game. And I would argue that the crucial thing to do at the very first moments of that game are to get the players interacting with each other. So if it's not important, particularly that this character trusts Kragar, but just that this character trusts someone, and that there are both trust relationships and wary relationships among the group, you could stop and go, well, wait a minute, instead of just predetermining which relationship is which, why don't I instead install a section at the beginning where all of the players introduce their characters and then create those relationships in the early moments, so that they still have a backstory, they still have something to play, but it's moved off of the character sheet and into a group discussion between each other. That has other advantages, right? If you have one player too few and nobody plays Kragar, you're sort of stuck with, oh no, I thought I've made this integral set of relationships between six characters and I've got four characters. Now what do I do? That allows more improvising at the table and still gives the players something to play, but it's something that they help develop and therefore are invested in, at least to the extent of remembering what the heck it is, maybe.
Yeah. And also, players feel more ownership and value in something that they made up as opposed to something they read on the character sheet, which is why even those little opening style, which character do you know before, which character are you suspicious of type question sessions, sort of like the character creation from Dread or from Fear Itself, become relevant even outside a horror game, because they establish emotional tone, and also they make the player feel more in sync with their character. Depending on the level of improv in the scenario, one thing that I would often ask players in a one-shot for a Cthulhu game is, tell me your character's greatest fear, or tell me the worst thing that they ever did. And then that lets the players sort of decide, do I want to be the guy who screams and runs or the guy who screams and bites people? And that sort of lets them, you know, get into the sort of the lust mode of Cthulhu gaming, which I think is generally a good thing in play in general, getting into the desire to engage with the central tenet of the game. You just don't usually have to activate that as much. But I could see in an F20, you know, why does your character need treasure? Being a great first question to ask. And then that lights up everybody as you go into the dungeon. And some people will just say, because it's treasure. That's why they call it treasure. And other people will say, no, I need it to rebuild my dwarven hall that was ravaged by a dragon 100 years ago or whatever else. And then you start getting character stories that pop a little bit off the page and that more importantly came out of the player's head, as opposed to out of the would-be novelist GM's head.
Right. And what that does is it combines your element as the GM or scenario designer. You need someone to be invested in going into the house that you've inherited from your uncle. So that's the playable thing that you need to work. And then you've had the players build something on top of that. So you're definitely going into this old house, even though it would otherwise seem like a bad idea. What is the need that you have that will be fulfilled by going into that house? So you've presented the premise, presented the action that they need to take, but then you let them create something on top of that. And that's just going to be much stronger for that player than whatever it is that you would think of. You know, they will pick one of the four most obvious answers to that question, from need the money to want to understand my parentage, whatever it is. And maybe they will, you know, surprise the GM by coming up with something even more original than you would have thought of, which is another reason to leave things kind of open. Or even if not, even if they're thinking of the most obvious thing, that's the thing that they thought of and care about and are invested in. So my short answer to this question is a great pre-gen gives something active for the player to do, starts them on the road to creative suggestion, and then lets them fill something in on top of that creative suggestion to make it theirs. And having recapitulated, we all know what happens now. We head to another hut to start a segment all over again.
I want high fantasy investigative adventure.
But Ken, there's only one of you.
I got you there. You are a GM, Robin.
You do have me there.
And a GM and a player is all you need for Paragon Blade, the gumshoe one-to-one game of swords and spells.
In the Paragon Blade from fantasy master Gareth Ryder Hanrahan, you play a hero in a fantastical land, still scarred by the evil of the fallen hellbound empire.
Mystery and magic collide in tales of conspiratorial wizards, monstrous foes, and arcane intrigue.
Gather your wits, your allies, and your blade.
Three advantages see you through the perils that await.
A trusty companion, a wise mentor, a stalwart servant, or cryptic ally.
A relic from the dark days of old, a treacherous artifact of terrible power.
And most of all, you're a hero of great skill and insight. You'll read the riddle of this broken world and battle evil in all its many forms.
Paragon Blade includes all the rules you need for an intense head-to-head experience in the fantasy vein.
Plus, detailed guidance on building your own heroes and quests.
Fits superbly with virtual tabletops.
Comes with three scenarios with the heroes designed to plumb their mysteries.
Barbarian hero Khan the Unslain must race against time to seek a cure for a demonic curse in Heart of the Beast.
Aletheia the Scholar must conceal her sorcerer's powers from her father the Magistrate while helping him investigate the Isle of Death.
Puck the Thief must steal the Jar of Doom before anyone else opens it.
Paragon Blade, now available at the Palgrain web store.
Or at a discerning game retailer near you.
The swing of pickaxes, the wearing of pith helmets, and the activation of the LiDAR machine tell us we're once more in the archaeology hut. And this time around, we have a sequel, because in 696, we mentioned one site, a possible inspiration for the labyrinth, recently discovered digging up an airport site. But Ken, you found one that you thought is not only a better candidate because it's not just a circular structure, but seems much more like a place you'd send your adventurers down into. And I think in many ways is a better candidate. And that is the complex of Gorton. So why don't you lay this possible labyrinth on us?
Right. Gorton is about 20 miles or a little less from Knossos. So it's fundamentally a suburb or a sister city of Knossos. By the Hellenistic era, the 4th century BC, it becomes the main city of Crete, and the Romans even made it the capital of Crete. And so it was very, very important, and then it got sacked by the Saracens and stopped being important, and that is where we are today. The near Gorton, inside basically a hill, there is a number of tunnels and chambers, 2.5 kilometers of tunnels and 9,000 square meters of chambers, as far as anyone has measured. These are known to the locals as the Labyrinthos Caves. I suspect the locals gave it that name after enough British people came by to say, where's the labyrinth?
Where's the labyrinth? Well, I have the Labyrinthos Canteen right here.
Right here.
Right next to the entrance of the Labyrinthos
Caves. Welcome to the Labyrinthos Livery Stable. They'll rent you a horse to go to the Labyrinthos Caves. So it began as a quarry. The evidence is pretty clear of chisel marks on the tunnels and everything else. So it may have begun as a cave or two and then been dug out as a quarry, or it may have always and forever been a quarry. It is impossible to tell by now, as we will get to, but it was certainly a quarry. The question that archaeologists ask is, how old a quarry is it? It certainly goes before Roman times, probably well before Roman times. And one theory, which is my theory, by the way, is that it was the quarry for the palaces of Phaistos, which is another Minoan city nearby. And that would have put it around 1700 BC. So roughly contemporaneous with the Papura rings. It's opened up as a quarry. The quarrying continues down to Roman times, we know. And then eventually they ran out of rock to dig out of it. It's not great rock. It's sort of limestone and sandstone mixed in that hill. So you're just quarrying the very basic sorts of stone. It's not for marble, even much less anything very nice. But it's good for building, and they had a whole hill of rock that they dug out. So the first outsider post-Saracens to show up is a guy named Cristoforo Buondelamondi. And in 1415, he shows up and he says, where's the labyrinth? And they said, oh, you mean Labyrinthos Cave over there.
It's right here by my canteen.
And he describes it as, there is to the east a first corridor of 200 steps. Another one with a northern direction seems to be endless. At least that's what the locals claim, which is big talk for Cristoforo, but there we are. We observe many galleries entangling one another, and all of which seem to come back to the point where they begin. So if you look at contemporary maps, it sort of makes a big arc around. There are other entrances into the sides of the hill, and then there's sort of, as a quarry, you know, they would have dug around the edges and then started digging into the middle, and that's what you get, is this sort of tangly web of passages and chambers. A British fellow named Bernard Randolph in 1680 explored. He said, aha, it's a labyrinth. I'm going to bring a string. He only has 100 meters of string. He says, this was a terrible idea. And he also mentions that the cave is full of bats. And one of the things that people would do is they would go into the caves and they would gather bat guano to use as fertilizer. I'm sort of hitting the highlights. There's any number of other, especially English visitors that people on English language websites mention. A couple of guys in Elizabethan times.
Yeah. Some of them have 90 meters of string. Some of them have 110 meters.
You're right. It's just a wide variety of string. In 1783, two French army officers, Bonneval and Dumas, map it on the orders of Louis XVI, who wants to know about possible naval bases in Crete in case he's going to go to war with the Ottomans, or I suppose with the British. And so Louis XVI sends them out and they map the labyrinth as much as they can. And then it is mapped again and again and again by different guys in the 19th century. And each mapper, if you look at their maps next to each other, finds new chambers that the previous mapper didn't find. So the maps sort of overlap, but they also kind of don't. And the question is, did new chambers get dug out? Did they get explored? Or is there something else weird going on? Or is it just mapping these caverns is very, very hard if you don't have GPS, and so natural drift in mapping. So by World War II, the Nazis take over Crete, and they use it as an ammo dump. They keep up to 300,000 tons of ammo in it, according to later legend. In 1944, when they leave Gortyn, they blew up one of the entrances, but there were other entrances that the Nazis either didn't know about or didn't bother to blow up. But that act of demolition brought down a bunch of tunnels and chambers. The Greek partisans are also not supposed to be sneaking in and taking all the ammo. So the Greek army snuck in and took all the ammo in 1945 and 46. The Greek government in the 50s for a while paid a contractor to sort of clear out the Nazi damage, reinforce the tunnels, make it possible to go in and out. That lasted as long as the budget did. There was a number of accidents that people did not like going into the labyrinth for obvious reasons. Then in 1961, some of the unremoved ammo blows up, kills four people, and they said, well, enough of that. It's been on and off closed since then. 2010 is the most recent closing, and it does not seem to have reopened. So if you are a tourist in Gortyn and you ask, where's the labyrinth? They will say, it's closed. Labyrinth is closed. Sorry, man. Or maybe they'll say, come to the canteen and ask where no one's watching. I don't know. And that is my candidate, and I think a lot of people's candidate, and certainly the locals of Gortyn's candidate, for the Labyrinth of Knossos, because it would have been a bunch of creepy tunnels. You absolutely would have taken Mycenaean hostages and put them in it to make them dig for a rock if they were bad. And sure, the queen gives birth to a minotaur. Where better to stash him than in these tunnels that are relatively easily watched the exits of, at any rate? And then once the Hesiod or whoever heard about, you know, how twisty they were, he said, oh, that must have been a maze designed by Daedalus. He was a Greek, you know, not from Crete at all. Just a point I'd like to make. And then the Cretans would get mad.
And mythically speaking, it also makes sense because this is near a spring shaded by plane trees where Zeus, when he assumed the form of a white bull and kidnapped Europa, took her here, and they had three sons. But the one who's pertinent here is Minos, the one for whom the Minoans are named. And he was appointed by Zeus as the king of Knossos, presumably, you know, as an early adult, one would think. And his wife, Pasiphae, of course, is the one who insulted Poseidon and was therefore cursed to bear monsters as children and had the Minotaur as a son. So the Minotaur is the grandson of Zeus, and that all makes sense because he was a white bull for a chunk of that time. So this all tracks and all adds mythic resonance to this. This site also makes a cameo in the Odyssey when Menelaus's ships are pounded against nearby reefs. So that suggests that Poseidon is also active in the area, that he's vigilant and angry. And so if you are going into this labyrinth looking for things either in the 30s before it's full of unexploded ordnance or now when there's all sorts of stuff in there that could blow up, he too may be looking to mess with you. So, Ken, what sort of mission do you think we would send, say, the Delta Green members into? Fall of Delta Green is an era after the ordnance, mm-hmm. but before they're closed. So what are Delta Green agents going to be looking for, because they know there's something angry in the sea and they know it ain't Poseidon.
Right. Well, the problem is that, yes, there are Deep One colonies out in south of Greece. This is established lore. So the Deep Ones are active in the area. But the problem that they would have is that the Karatekia, the Nazi magician crew, got wind of the fact that, oh, we have the labyrinth. And they went down into the labyrinth to find the Minotaur and summon it up. And maybe they're looking for its bones to be used in necromancy, or maybe they realize that the Minotaur is just a cover for some sort of aspect of Shub-Niggurath or something. And so they went down into that dungeon and they did awful, awful things. And maybe the Karatekia team never came out either. And that's why it was left for a later agency to clear up. So, you know, it shows up, they're doing a document review of World War II, and they say, this is odd. We have this, you know, bunch of Karatekia files for Operation Asterion, Fall Asterion, and there's no after-action report. Oh, that's because they went into the Minos, the labyrinth of Minos, Well, I guess you got to go in and find out what happened. Oh, by the way, it's full of unexploded Nazi ordnance. So the good news is if you find a horrible Shoggoth Minotaur, you got lots of stuff to blow it up with. But the bad news is you'll be in the tunnels with it. So good luck, boys.
Yes. Be careful on Operation Shoggothor.
Right.
And now that we're portmanteauing mythological and Cthulhuid entities, it's time for us to get the heck out of here before they start to multiply. So let's see what entirely safe subject waits for us on the other side of this here commercial.
Play The King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, The King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tyne's famous clairvoyants divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality-shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com. Protect this podcast from the pain of melodrama by joining beloved Patreon backers
Jean-Francois Paradis,
Louis R. Evans,
Mark Waterhouse,
Pedro Garcia,
and Tennant Reed.
The Freitag's triangle in the corner, the rising action all around us, the drama masks hanging from the walls, grinning or weeping, as befits them, tell us that we are in a hut of abstraction, a hut of story, to wit, the narrative hut. And in the narrative hut, beloved Patreon backer Nikolai asks, a couple of episodes ago, you mentioned the difference between drama and melodrama. I apparently need a primer on that and would appreciate some advice on how to bring them into play. Robin, you have gone bananas on the melodrama, so I'm going to let you go bananas on the melodrama. All I was going to say is it began as drama with music, which is to say all drama, but as with so many things, that meaning has shifted. So take it away. Shift us, Robin. Right.
Yes. Listeners to the Narrative Hut will be surprised to learn that there's a analytical or critical term about narrative that has multiple meanings, some of them pejorative, which are often misused. And so, as you point out, combining theater with music is nothing new. The theater that we know of in the beginning, that the Greeks had music in it. But the term melodrama specifically is used in English in the late 18th century to refer to a style imported from mostly from France, with a little bit of Germany thrown in there. And it was a style of highly emotional, exciting, spectacular theater that combined singing and dancing to enhance the emotional effects of the staged action. And so this became a melodrama, a drama with melody, with music. And of course, this was entirely separate from opera, which is a whole other thing, in which acting and dancing enhance the emotional effect of a singing performance. And so even as it was first adopted, there is side eye thrown at this as if it was not quite cricket. And consequently, even today, the descriptions that you find in any putatively just straight up analytical definition are full of pejorative assessments,
right,
that reflect a bias that we'll explore it a bit later. But they will say, these have improbable plots and stock characters, and they're bombastic and sentimental. And it's like,
critics have always hated the musical, Robin. It's not new.
Yes. As opposed to, you know, say the extremely tight, locked down plotting of William Shakespeare where nothing improbable ever happens or there are no stock characters.
Yes, or the deeply multidimensional characters of Clifford Odets and George Bernard Shaw.
Right. Well, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves there. But indeed, in the 20th century and later, people have forgotten these no longer performed plays that were adapted from France and now use it to refer to stories of emotional upheaval and suffering, often directed at women. Oh, guess, I wonder why those are being denigrated, something aimed at women.
Who can say?
Yeah. And examples in the early 20th century would be the genre known as women's pictures, which were star vehicles for people like Bette Davis or Joan Crawford or Barbara Stanwyck in a sort of mid-period. And they didn't call them melodramas per se. I guess in the writer's hut, they probably did because they knew their history. Mm-hmm. But they were known in the studio system as women's pictures. And of course, soap operas, which began on radio and then went to television when television became active. And they are mostly about people's emotions running wild, hot feelings, a lot of focus on love and romance. And because of their focus on not only on women, but on feeling, there's a big kinship between the gay community and those films. And those are people who still revere all of those actresses and the many good films made in that format. And so melodrama was continued to be an insult. It still is an insult, but it was even a worse insult for a long time until an auteurist understanding arose around the 1950s films of Douglas Sirk, a German emigre filmmaker who made things like Written on the Wind and All That Heaven Allows. And because his melodramas fulfill all of these things about being about women and emotions and about also the visuals of clothing and social byways, but they had an ironic sensibility to them. And that's what allowed straight dudes to appreciate them as well. And so through beginning to understand Sirk as an auteur and the different levels that he was working on, the melodrama enjoyed sort of a level of critical acceptability where people were willing to go back and look at these things as this is another important genre that we have to study and one in which many auteurs worked and one that audiences responded to. And there are a lot of them that are just really great films. They're just working in a different genre than the tight-lipped straight dudes want to necessarily focus on. Yeah,
the overlap both in subject matter and structure and of critical response between the melodrama and the gothic, I think, is pretty instructive, because the gothic also is wild plots, stock characters, focuses on emotion. It's often about the scenery and the setting as opposed to the costumes, but it's still something other than the words of the play. And the gothic, of course, word got hijacked to refer to women's novels that were about women in danger as opposed to women specifically in love. And so you have the sort of the classic paperback image of the woman in a low cut bodice running out of a creepy mansion. And that picture is the gothic, but that's also often half of a melodrama, as it sets up as a gothic and then it resolves with a happy ending. And that goes back to the earliest gothics as well, in which the gothic sets up the problem, the highly emotional problem, and then an emotional charge is released in the solution of it. And I would argue that goes back to the Greek plays that were also melodramas, as we talked about. But
right.
Yeah, the gothic is a sidelight, I think it makes an interesting comparison. And it's another way into melodrama, because Douglas Sirk made a couple of sort of noir-infused films, certainly earlier in his career. And that's another way into Douglas Sirk for people who come at it from a horror dude sensibility,
right.
Speaking of denigrated critical topics.
Right. And we'll circle back to that in a bit. Let me just jump back into the history of the understanding of the melodrama. And so
right.
One director in the 1970s who's very specifically informed by the melodrama is the German director Rainer Werner Fassbinder. He makes a lot of films in his short life. A lot of them are very based on Sirk, and he is overtly infusing many of them with his gay sensibility. And since then, directors like François Ozon, Todd Haynes, and Pedro Almodovar have continued that tradition of recognizing and elevating the importance of the melodrama and the importance of female-centered narrative as well. So from a structural writing perspective, the thing that Nikolai was hearing me say that I think is useful, so this I'm picking one of the many definitions of melodrama, is that drama, action arises from the choices of the characters. In melodrama, characters react emotionally when the world impinges upon them. And so it is almost sort of a procedural narrative in which you're having emotional reactions to things that affect you. And the power of the melodrama is that it tells stories for people who do not have agency. It's about people who lack agency. In most every culture of the world, that starts with women. And consequently, you see the huge popularity of melodrama in Asian cinema, for example. In Asian cultures, the idea that you have control over your destiny and that your personal choices are the things that determine how things are going to turn out for you. You just need to look at history to know that that ain't true. That's not how it works. There are many more people who've been buffeted by external forces than can claim that they made their own choices and realized their tragic downfall or their comedic union. And so in Asian cinema, not only do you have this vast panoply of films in the suffering woman melodrama genre, but in some of these regional Asian cinemas, like Hong Kong, for example, every genre is also a melodrama. So everything from a goofball comedy to a heroic bloodshed film can veer into melodrama at any moment. That is the chassis on which all storytelling is based, and the idea that you are a person with agency driving a narrative, that is not the main thing. So for our purposes, though, to determine whether a plot element that you want to introduce is dramatic or melodramatic, look at the level of personal choice involved in it. Is it internal or external? So if the protagonist enters the fighting arena to avenge his father, that's drama. If he enters the fighting pits because he's captured and thrown into them, that's melodrama. If the protagonist marries the scoundrel because she's blinded by love, that's drama. If she marries a scoundrel because there's been a scandal, perhaps some sort of contrivance, and she has to do it in order to save her family's reputation, that's melodrama. If the protagonist's problems are solved at the end when she embraces forgiveness, that's a drama. If they're solved when it turns out that she's secretly of noble parentage and that solves everything for her, that is melodrama. And external things coming in and affecting the characters, whether they be tragic accidents, illness, choices made out of poverty or social convention or constraint, are melodramatic staples. And I would argue that in real life, more of us are the big moments in our lives are not because of choices that we've made, but of life coming for us and hitting us on the head with fate's hammer. And so the melodrama, even though it is usually heavily stylized in order to be bearable and to have pleasure introduced into a world of suffering, is probably more naturalistic on a structural level than a lot of purely character-driven drama. I would add a third style of narrative to the polar opposition of melodrama and drama, and that is, of course, the procedural, the one in which people solve external problems. We could call that the romance, because that's the original title of the genre that it was based on, but that term is now hopelessly confused. So I think procedural is probably a better term for that now. So Nikolai's question includes, how do we bring those into play? And it's actually very simple, because first of all, you only really need to bring them into play in a primarily emotional or non-procedural game like Drama System or Page Turners or the, you know, the zillion other story games that work this territory. But dramatic events come from the players, and melodramatic events are curveballs from the GM. And an otherwise extremely tangled definitional thing is solved by the mechanics of our form. And so if the player decides that she drives into town to confront her ex, that is drama. If the GM decides that she's in a car crash on her way home, that's melodrama. When you want to introduce melodrama, I think a lot of players, if they feel that their game is about them having control over their characters, they are going to want you to lean heavily toward drama, because that means them driving the story. They may be quite upset if you have their mother suddenly get cancer or their car go off the road or any of the other staple events of melodrama. They may not want to play downtrodden people who are under the thumb of social convention. They probably, even in a dramatic field, want to play an aspirational story of empowerment. And so as much as people might enjoy melodrama in the safety of their own home, it's a strong spice that you might want to introduce cautiously into your game, especially in a world where everybody, whether they're gay or straight or men or women, have an innate bias against this part of narrative and this part of life, because no one likes it when life comes for you.
Well, what can I add to that, except that life comes for us in the form of an ad, which we must react to as characters without agency, but we can react with beautiful clothing and exciting songs and dances. And then we can take agency and go to another hut.
The British are coming!
To the American South and the lands over the mountains in Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
Ken and Robin listeners can download a free PDF copy of the core rules from nationsandcannons.com using code KenRobin.
And educators can get a physical copy for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West, with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
Salvage the rebels' foreign alliances in Haiti and Spanish New Orleans.
Recover a mysterious map from Daniel Boone.
Sail into the heart of darkness, investigating George Rogers Clark's strange conquest of Vincennes.
Escape when all seems lost at Savannah and Charleston.
Fight the guerrilla war alongside the Swamp Fox in a fast-moving hex crawl.
And save the revolution at the climax at York. Town.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. It's time once more to step into that most mysterious of huts, the one where we're just not sure what's going on, because over in the corner there's a guy who seems to be writing a crank history, and he's having an argument with a guy who's making a crank map. Oh, wait a minute. If we look out the window, there's the moor. There's the alien big cat screaming on the moor. Oh, we must be in the Elliptony Hut, the gathering place for unclassifiable weirdness of all sorts. And this time around, our usual guests over in the corner drinking their kombucha, in one case have their ears perked up, and the other case doesn't have ears, but he's still listening. That's the Nordic alien and the gray alien, because they're always very happy when they get back in the news. And we know that you, the listener, when there's a new UFO event, you need Ken to explain, is this a thing? So that you, in jaded fashion, can tell your friends authoritatively that this is not a thing. And the latest thing that may not be a thing is the latest Pentagon UFO document drop. So, Ken, you want to give us, first of all, some context on why these documents are being released now?
Well, because our president is a guy who has sudden impulses. And one of his sudden impulses is, I'm going to release the UFO files. That'll make everyone happy. I guess on the grounds of, if anyone becomes president, like, the third thing you want to do is go to Area 51 and say, show me the aliens.
Yeah. And that's how we know there are no aliens in storage, because he would have told us on day two of his first term.
Right. Yes. Of term one, we'd be introduced to the gray ambassadors from Zeta Reticuli. But as it is, one of our favorite stars, you've got to love it, Reticulum, they call it the net. Don't they call it the net, people? Anyway, so he said, we're going to release some UFO files, and he has the Pentagon, which surely has nothing better to do, go through its tranches and tranches, and they've set up a sort of a central informational clearinghouse, so the FBI gets to dump its stuff. Everybody's going through, I think it's under the Director of National Intelligence, but you know, God knows where it actually is, whose X-File office this is.
Right. But, and usually, you know, in the show, the X-Files, no one wants to do that. But here, I think there's a lot of people like, can I just ride out this administration doing this dumb job and maybe not get fired? Let's go declassify some UFO documents.
So this is the first of the tranches that we are promised will be released. We will see. But on May 8th of this year, they released 158 files, and you can go to the Pentagon website and count, and it says at the top 158 files, which does not prevent reputable news agencies, the BBC, from saying 170 files. And it's like, I'm Very sorry, there's 158. It says so right on the page. So anyway, we begin with that lovely bit of uncertainty, but these files are by and large all eyewitness reports of UFOs. There is no file of whatever government investigation happened. There's no government commentary. It's just the raw sighting data. And the earliest that I was able to find in the trench is a Foo Fighter report from 1945. So that's great. And that seems to be like a document that has a summary of Foo Fighter reports. So it's actually a bunch of reports in one. And then the latest imagery that's up there is 2025. So you've got basically 80 years of UFOs right there, or UAPs as they're called now. The sort of the highlights of them are the UFO sightings reported from Gemini 7, Apollo 11, 12, and 17. On all of those missions, the astronauts saw stuff they couldn't explain and said, "Hey, Houston, what's those weird lights?" And Houston said, "Not on this channel." And that was it. So another fun thing from it is various State Department cables reporting, you know, UFO sightings. And these begin in 1985 and end in 2004, but they're from Papua New Guinea, Kazakhstan, Georgia, Turkmenistan, and Mexico. And so someone somewhere is gathering these up because the State Department doesn't just cable, you know, when they're bored. So this means even in the eras where a blue book is gone and UFO hunting is officially deprecated, the Reagan, Bush, Clinton era, people are still up to doing it. So that's that actually is a fun piece of information, but that doesn't have routing information. Doesn't say where the State Department sent those cables when they got them, which would have been the fun part. People have seen, I think, the biggest, most exciting image is this aircraft flying around that looks like an eight-pointed star, like the star of Arioch. It looks incredibly like some sort of animation, but it's from 2013, and they're keeping very hush-hush about it. They say it's from Central Command, which just means, you know, stuff that isn't in Europe or Africa. And actually, in 2013, I think Central Command may have included Africa. And it was from a military platform, which I love. And then there's this eight-pointed star just sort of vibing around. It seems very much like a visual artifact of some kind that, you know, someone, you know, didn't turn off Star of Arioch setting on their gun camera or something. But it's wild looking stuff. And I think that, you know, you want to draw a cool UFO in the latter days of the war on terror. That's the one to go with, that Star of Arioch thing. We've got military jet sightings and camera footage from 2022 and 2023 and 2024. These are from Syria, Iraq, the United Arab Emirates, and undisclosed locations in the Middle East, which of course means over Iran. So lots of exciting little dots that are moving faster than dots ought to move is what most of those are. I'm not as thrilled with them because little dots moving is almost always a camera artifact or a software artifact by now. There is a fun one, though. It's a little diamond-shaped one, and it's flying over the water, and it's seen off Greece in 2023, and it does multiple 90-degree turns, but it's going a relatively decorous 80 miles an hour, which makes me think, this is a drone. We're watching a drone. Are we watching our drone? Are we watching China's drone? Those are the only two drones that probably matter, so who knows what drone that is, but that's a drone.
Yeah.
It's just doing something really cool. I think
some of the aforementioned dots could also be drones.
Those could also be drones. And then my favorite that isn't a Star of Arioch floating around and molesting American forces in 2013 is called the Western U.S. Sighting. And there is a 6-person team of federal agents identified only as PERS 1-6, no agency given. And they see and report UAPs, specifically orange orbs launching red orbs. So somewhere in the Western U.S. And again, this sounds like drones coming off a balloon if you're going to be a fun ruiner about it. But one team, the Mulder and Scully on this team, not only see those orbs launching orbs, they also saw a large fiery orb like the Eye of Sauron from Lord of the Rings, except without the pupil. That's straight up government report language. And a dark kite hovering 2 to 3 feet off the ground, which they thought was a car that they were following. And then they flipped their lights at it and there was no car there. There was just the lights in this sort of flat plane. And then the flat plane turned off the road and went into the desert without going bumpity bump over the edge of the road.
I really found the low level, the ground hugging weird objects to be somehow even more evocative and creepy than the ones way up in the sky somehow.
Well, because it's more uncanny. You think it's tail lights, and then suddenly it's not. And I think that's really fun. And then they also, later that same day, saw a floating transparent kite, like a ghost floating around. And that Mulder Scully episode in 2023 is something. I mean, we're going to have to wait for Ryan Coogler to tell us what it was, but that's my favorite of these unleashed things. Avi Loeb, our beloved alien finder at Harvard, says that the mission sightings are probably cosmic rays, a rare fun ruining role for him. And I guess that closes out that tranche of documents. A lot of them, you know, I said 158, but a lot of them are individual frames of a motion picture. So when you really pull it down, it's probably closer to 70 or 80 individual sightings, which is still good, right? I mean, that's 80 new sightings that we didn't necessarily have. And some of them, like that Western U.S. sighting or the Star of Arioch or the fact that the State Department is finding UFOs for somebody in the 80s. I mean, who doesn't want to know about Reagan's secret UFO team?
So it seems like you're slightly less down on this than you were when we originally discussed it in a Zoom call.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying this is smoking gun, there are aliens. What I'm saying is, as with any collection of UFO reports, once you dig into it, there's going to be story meat there. That's what I'm saying about it. I do wish that a guy who is predisposed to believe in aliens didn't say it's not aliens about the Apollo mission once, because I think those are the most fun. But I do like the Star of Arioch, even though it's very clearly an artifact of some kind of software. And the Western U.S. sighting is, as I say, an X-Files episode, complete with a new kind of UAP sighting to me anyway, the taillights that aren't taillights. And that's kind of baller.
The dark kite is pretty great. It's too bad there's not a little bit more documentary evidence there, but I guess it's a way that, you know, they can just build up more of these files. And then whenever somebody starts pacing around the personal quarters of the Oval Office at 3 a.m. and wants a different headline tomorrow, he can have some more fired off. And there might be some other cool, weird things in there. It is clearly mostly just sort of reports with no investigation behind it, and also quite cryptic ones in a lot of cases. But if you are looking to add UFOs, and I have no truck with the UAP business. That's just not nearly as fun to say. I don't know why we switched. But if you're looking to add an element like that, I think a dark kite that turns out to be an outer dark entity would be a great element in like an esoterist or a fear itself horror that you could take that a long way into the dark woods.
As well as, you know, what is up in Papua New Guinea when we're seeing UFOs in 1985. I think that's fun just right there.
Well, now that people know that, in fact, there are some cool things in there that they can talk about it to their normie friends. But speaking of something that isn't normie, it's this podcast. And we're done for this week, but we'll be back with another very similar podcast a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Make sure this podcast doesn't run out of string alongside such backers as...
Theron Bretz.
Toonspew.
Kevin H.
Andrew Cowie.
And Andrew Dacey.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time, and once again, we will talk about stuff.